This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members of FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
You're listening to Working, the podcast about what people do all day. I'm Jacob Brogan. This season on Working, as you may know, we've been telling stories of working animals. But this episode, we're taking a step back from that for just one episode to talk to and about one of my favorite writers. We sat down with the great Neil Gaiman, author of the Sandman comics, of the novel American Gods, of almost countless other stories. Many genres, many media. We talked with Neil about his working process. We talked with him especially about his work on one of his most recent projects, his book Norse Mythology, in which he retells some centuries-old stories of the Norse gods and giants. It's a terrific book, and it was fascinating to hear both about how he went about retelling these ancient stories and how those stories reflect the way that he has written, created, and thought throughout his career. Then, in a Slate Plus Extra, we let some Slate staffers, including this show's own producer, Benjamin Frisch, join us in the studio to ask Neil their burning questions, the questions they've always wanted to ask him. It was a lot of fun, and his answers are fascinating and genuinely good. If you're a Slate Plus member, you can get that and other great Slate Plus extras. To start your two-week free trial today, go to slate.com/workingplus. What is your name and what do you do?
My name is Neil Gaiman, and I make things up and very often write them down. I'm a writer.
Yes.
And it gets awkward for me when I'm in cabs in particular. And, you know, you're talking to the cab driver and the cab driver says, "So what do you do?" And I say, "Well, I'm a writer." And they say, "Well, what kind of stuff do you write then? What do you write? Well, I've heard of you." And I'm like, "Well, all sorts." And they're like, "Well, so what? What are we talking here? Novels, children's books, adult books, fiction, nonfiction?" And I'm like, yeah, all of that. And after a while, I can see that they're just sort of going, "He's winding me up." Nah. But I do. I write adults' books, and I write children's books, and I write fiction, and I write nonfiction. And I write songs and poems, and I write movies and TV. And I write all sorts of things. And you know, most recently, a big retelling of myths. Norse mythology is the most recent thing. In terms of jobs, I've actually just spent the last 8 months with a real job.
A real job?
A real job. Real jobs for me.
Writing not being a real job in this case.
Writing anything that doesn't force you to get up at a specific time in the morning or set an alarm clock for me is not a real job, which is writing. So writing is never a real job.
Sure. Yeah.
Because I start when I feel like starting and I go on until I'm done. Yeah. So that's not a real job. That's fun. There's been a whole world of 6 a.m. and occasionally 5 a.m. alarm clocks because I've been showrunning the adaptation of Good Omens, which is a novel that I wrote with Terry Pratchett almost 30 years ago. And I wrote that with Terry before Terry died, he asked if I would do the television adaptation as a thing for him. And so I wrote a 6-episode adaptation and then realized that just sort of handing it blithely over to people to do what they wanted with was not necessarily going to take us to a place that Terry or I would have been happy with.
Yeah.
So I became showrunner, which meant that I've been casting people, I approve all the costumes, I've been working hand in hand with our astonishingly fine director, Douglas McKinnon, glorious Scottish director, and we spent, we started shooting the end of August, and now we finished shooting in a couple of days in South Africa.
Wow.
And I left a week early, which has been in order to come on the road and tell people about Norse mythology.
We're so happy to have you here to talk about that and this other work. How much of your time do you actually spend actively writing these days? Is it something that you are able to commit to every day? Was it ever something that you were committed to every day?
It was definitely something that I was committed to every day. Dealing with things like, you know, show running has kind of upended my life a bit. I used to be, and it also depends on what I was doing and for whom.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when I was writing Sandman, a monthly comic,
3,000-page series, almost, I think.
Yep.
2,000 pages, something like this.
I think
many thousands.
Probably
of pages.
2.5 by the time it was done.
Yeah.
2,000, and then there's been add-on things.
Yeah.
That are probably another 500 pages. So when I was doing that, I had to write 4 pages a day of comics every day.
Mm-hmm.
And what actually would happen was I might, you know, day one, I would probably write 1 page if I was lucky, as I would work my way into something. And then the last day of Sandman, I would probably go from page 18 to page 24 and write the last 6 pages. And because it would all be inevitable by that point. I'd already built a giant thing. But with that, I knew that if I didn't write it, there was an artist waiting, a letterer waiting, a colorist painting and waiting, and they wouldn't get paid.
Yeah.
With novels, I try and write every day. I try and set myself a target of 1,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you do 1,000 words every day in 100 days, you would have a 100,000-word novel.
Right.
And, of course, I fail.
Sure.
And that's okay. And then there are great days on which you do 2,000 or 3,000 words.
Yeah.
But mostly you fail and it's okay.
Yeah.
With Norse mythology, it was a bit strange. Because Norse mythology, I was invited to do it by Amy Cherry, who's an editor at Norton, in end of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Took me about a year before I said yes, because I was just thinking about how I would do it, how I could make it relevant, if I had the chops, and if I did have the chops, how what I wanted to do if I did it was write a book of mythology that would feel as important on a bookshelf as, I don't know, Edith Hamilton's mythology or something.
And maybe it's worth saying something about the form of this book, Norse mythology, because I think that may be important to understanding what the process of writing it involved, which is that it is a close but creative adaptation of versions of these stories, these Norse stories, 800-plus-year-old stories, as told in the prose and poetic Edda.
Absolutely.
These 12th and 13th century-ish texts from Iceland, I guess.
I love that phrase, close and creative, because both of those things are true. They are close adaptations in that you could use them in a school or a university.
Mm-hmm.
You are not going to get into trouble.
Yes.
They are accurate. They are creative in that we move inside the heads of people.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about, you know, you add the storytelling corroborative detail that you imagine might have been told around campfires when these stories were told.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's one where that this was the point at which I genuinely love this book, but the point at which I really felt that I got what you're doing is one in which you're telling a story about, I think, the goddess Freya, and some giant wants to marry her, and you, all the other gods, all the other Aesir, these Norse deities are kind of fine with it. They're like, let's just go along with this. And you take us in that moment into Freya's head and give us this sense of her own perspective on being asked to marry this literal brute that she has no real interest in.
Absolutely. And it's fun because Snorri's original retelling of this story, he makes it very clear that Freya says no and is upset and angry. But I tried to go, okay, let's give her agency. Let's make her smart and let's have her see the inevitable failure of the gods' cunning plan to try and get a wall built for nothing.
Hmm.
You know, if there's one thing that you learn from Norse mythology, it's never try and get huge walls built to keep people out and then get those people to build the walls for you.
It'll get everyone into trouble.
It's going to get people into trouble.
That way leads only to madness and Ragnarok, perhaps. Well, I want to talk more about the book, since it is a particularly recent thing in your career, but I'd also love to first take a step back and talk about how you found your way into this kind of work of writing in the first place. You emerged out of the comic scene primarily. Some of your first published work was Buzz Comics.
Absolutely. I started out as a journalist, a sort of self-invented journalist. I don't know if you could do it today, but I think you probably could. In that I wanted to be a writer of fiction and prose, wrote some short stories, sent them out, watched them come back with little notes on them saying, no, thank you. And I went, holy shit, I need to... I need to know how this works.
Yeah.
I need to know how the world works.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that being a journalist would be a very good way to find out how the world works, and also a good way to write while learning how to write, because I'm going to have to write. And anyway, I have no real skills, and I may as well just get on with something. So I became a journalist specializing in science fiction and fantasy and horror, specializing in books and prose and the written word, with occasional sort of divergences off into film and so forth. And I did that for about 5 years. And by the end of that, I was very done. And I was also now writing comics.
You were writing for, was it 2000 AD at the time?
I wrote a couple of, about four shorts for 2000 AD.
Which is a British anthology comic that also helped launch the career of your contemporary Alan Moore.
Absolutely. Alan, Grant Morrison, Pete Milligan, all of the good British writers, I think, wet their whistles on 2000 AD. And then from 2000 AD, I went to, did a graphic novel called Violent Cases, which was published by Escape.
Mm-hmm.
And while we were working on Violent Cases...
It was with Dave McKean?
With the brilliant Dave McKean. True. And it was very much our book of showing the world the kinds of things that we thought should exist.
Mm.
The problem that I was having was I was saying to people, I think comics are an art form.
Mm-hmm.
And they would go, well, show me this art form. And I would go, well, here, have Art Spiegelman's mouse. And they would go, oh, small, scratchy, funny animal drawings of mice. And I go, oh, no, you're missing it. Well, look here, Watchmen, or here, Dark Knight Returns by Frank Miller and Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. And they go, well, yeah, but it's superheroes. I mean, come on.
Mm.
So Dave McKean and I, with the chutzpah of the young and the ignorant, went, oh, okay, well, then we have to make a piece of a comic that is obviously a piece of art, so that people understand it. And I wrote a short story about memory and violence. And Dave turned it into an amazing graphic novel.
Mm-hmm.
And we were halfway through that when some people from DC Comics came over to England on a talent scouting expedition. And Alan Moore put us in touch. And I went to a hotel room and pitched.
And this led ultimately to Sandman, the series that we've mentioned already, that I'm sure many people here listening to this episode will already be familiar with in one way or another. One thing that's striking about that series, though, looking back at some of its first issues, the first stories you're telling there, is that it was originally at least tenuously framed as a superhero story. The Sandman character, as we first meet him, was a reference to this Sandman superhero from the 1930s, no?
I would look back then with interest and admiration at what people like Alan Moore and Grant Morrison were doing with superheroes. And it was like watching, you know, beautiful dancers doing some kind of jazz dance. They could do this thing. And I would go, you know, I don't think I have any aptitude at that kind of jazz dance. I don't have that feeling for superheroes in the way that they do. But I think I can do stuff that is close enough to superheroes that people won't notice if I can just figure out ways to do it. So, for example, with Sandman, one of the big inspirations for me at the beginning going in was Roger Zelazny and Roger's Nine Princes in Amber and Roger's particularly a novel of his called Lord of Light, where he had the Hindu pantheon in science fiction terms. But because he'd got a pantheon of gods in the far future, of men as gods, they felt like superheroes. And I thought, okay, well, that thing that Roger did there, I don't think I can do superheroes, but I think I can do that thing. And that, for me, was what I took into Sandman in a lot of ways, and going, okay, well, it's going to begin as a sort of a horror comic. With any luck, it will then become fantasy in various different ways. But you know, I can push this, you know, this knob over here and twiddle this button and turn this dial and make it feel not entirely alien to somebody who loves superheroes.
Yeah.
Much in the same way, you know, almost two decades later, almost, over a decade later, I did a comic called Marvel 1602.
Yes.
And reinvented the Marvel universe.
But in 1602 in America.
In 1602, saying, okay, it happened 400 years early. And it's in England instead of America, and it comes to America at the end, and it's the New World. And a lot of that was me going, well, I love the Marvel characters. I don't think I can write superheroes in a convincing Marvel Universe kind of way, but I bet I could do an alternate history.
Yeah.
With essentially science fictional characters in it that would feel, that would give everybody the sort of joy that I got as a kid reading Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, reading Stan Lee and Steve Ditko, reading Stan Lee and Gene Colan. I could do that.
Part of the reason I wanted to talk to you about this is that I think one of the things that arguably defines the arc of your career, of your working process, is that you often are riffing on other people's stories in the process of inventing your own. And what you have done in the more recent Norse mythology book is quite different structurally, presumably creatively as well, than your earlier works. But there is a sort of echo there in the ways that you've taken, you know, the shadow of a very old comics character and somehow in the process unfolded out of that initial horror story something like a key to all mythologies, as you do in Sandman, that ultimately becomes a family drama, that ultimately becomes a tragedy of a sort. Maybe was all of those things all along as well. I assume that part of your own writing process has to be a reading process as well. You must read a great deal of other people's writing.
I think that's true. But it's also true that as an adult writer, what I tend to read is weird, obscure nonfiction. Mm. The kind of stuff that may one day turn into research, but you're never quite sure how. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, you know, settle down with the four volumes of Henry Mayhew's London Labour and the London Poor. And work your way through interviews with boys selling flypaper on the street, with you know, people who write begging letters or ladies of easy virtue. You're there, and it somehow immerses you in something that you can then take back with you. Yeah. Into fiction. But I think the thing that I had that was most important, and I didn't know it, was being a voracious reader, you know, full on Tasmanian devil, devouring as I went, voracious reader, from the smallest age. And really remained an obsessive and voracious reader until I think around somewhere in the 90s, when I had to judge the Arthur C. Clarke Award in the UK 2 years running.
Major science fiction prize.
Major science fiction prize. And one of the things in it is that you have to read every science fiction book published in the UK that year. And from wherever, from anywhere in the world. And year one, I made it through unscathed. And by year two, it started to feel like some kind of awful aversion therapy for somebody who loved reading.
Yeah.
You know, I'd get two chapters in and throw the book across the room and then go back and get it and put it down carefully because I'm not a barbarian. But, you know, there was definitely that point where reading genuinely became less fun.
Yeah.
Then, and it took a while for me to come back to fiction. Mm. And there are still favorite authors out there. I love authors who can make me forget that somebody is doing it. Mm. Because I suspect it's like magicians. Mm. Going to see a magic trick. You don't ever go, oh my God, how did that card go to the top of the deck? What you actually go is, ah, fantastic. He did Zimmerman's riffle flourish twice. And but actually did it backwards. What a remarkable thing. So you're sort of looking, you'd be looking at the magic with a different eye.
Yeah.
And the magicians that would astonish and amaze you would be the ones who would just, well, you're not going, well, obviously, you know, it's in your sleeve and then you've got a remote controlled thing here and then you're doing that. They're actually just going, ah, that was amazing. So for me, Jonathan Carroll can still make me forget that I'm a writer. Gene Wolfe makes me forget that I'm a writer. Ursula Le Guin makes me forget that I'm a writer.
Yeah.
The late Diana Wynne Jones could always make me forget that I was a writer.
Yeah.
And just make me a reader. Make me 100% a reader. Turn off all of my critical faculties and just make me enjoy the way the words go down and who the characters are. Charles Dickens can still do it to me.
Do you think your writing can do it?
No, because my writing is a different thing. I mean, I'm sure my writing can do it for other people.
Yeah.
Probably it can do it for some other authors. But I'm never going to sit down with a book that I've written and go,
I'm lost in this.
I'm lost in this. I believe in these characters. Yeah. I desperately want to know what happens next.
Yeah.
Because even if I pretend that I don't, even if it's such a long time ago that I wrote it, there's still a tiny part of me that will remember sitting there, bashing it out, or where I was when I wrote it, or what I was thinking.
Do you have an ideal environment that you prefer to sit down in? Are there conditions that are good for writing for you?
Far away from phones, far away from the internet.
It's difficult these days.
It is. It's hard. There was a point around, I think, 2007 where I needed to get some work on the graveyard book done. I needed to get the book started. And I actually found a cottage in Cornwall, which I got intentionally because it was in a completely dead zone, cell phone wise. And it would be, you know, I knew that I could go there and just fall off the map.
Sure. Yeah. In the endnotes to Norse mythology, you mentioned that one of the stories, possibly the last one, you were writing it in a similarly Wi-Fi free house, and there was a power outage, and you lost a draft, which sounds like just a nightmarish tragedy to me.
It was we were in Hudson, New York, in a house that we very briefly owned. Beautiful house on Warren Street in Hudson. And that my wife had originally gone, I will live here, and then you will live over here in Woodstock, and we will commute to each other. And it'll, and the moment that our baby turned up, it became very obvious
that quite difficult,
never
yes.
going to happen. So I was in a basically unfurnished house in Woodstock, in Hudson, and there was a blizzard. And previous times when I'd been there, I had stolen Wi-Fi from the shop next door, but the ladies next door were very sad that they had been sort of throttled back by their internet provider because they'd been too free and easy in giving out their IDs. So that didn't work anymore. I thought, well, what's the worst that can happen? And I discovered what the worst that can happen is...
You lose a whole draft.
Is you lose a whole draft.
And yet... You then rewrote it?
You know, it got better.
It's
the last story. It's Ragnarok.
Ragnarok, yeah.
And it's one of those things where there's never been a time that I've lost a draft that I haven't been angry and upset. There's also never been a time that I've lost a draft, redone it, and found the old draft, which has also happened a few times over, you know, that I didn't realize that actually the second time through, even though I was cursing myself for not being as good as the original, not having the power, not having the words, they were normally better. And what was lovely about this Ragnarok, my second time through, I went, I discovered the ending, which had kind of been waiting for me in the previous draft, but I didn't quite have it. And there's a moment in Snorri where he talks about after Ragnarok, the surviving gods, these young gods who are now taking over the halls where Asgard once was.
Gods who are also in many versions of Norse mythology, thinly disguised analogs of figures from Judeo-Christian tradition in some readings, I think.
I don't know about that.
All right. That's fair.
let me throw in my I don't know about that because it has been hypothesized that that is the case. However, we have no pilot version.
That's fair. Yeah.
We have nothing to compare.
We don't know what it looked like before this 12th, 13th century version.
And, you know, what we know that we have are 12th, 13th century versions by Snorri, poems collected around that time. We know we have that stuff, and we know it's post-Christian. It's 200 years post-Christian at that point in Iceland. But people going, well, I actually had one review of Norse mythology where they said, I was very disappointed that Gaiman did not present us with the pre-Christianized versions of these stories.
Where would you find it?
And I'm going, yes, where are these versions? Do you have them? No, you can make them up.
Yeah.
But one of my rules was I wasn't going to make stuff up. And as a result of which I go, you know, the idea of Ragnarok and the idea of the cyclical nature of Ragnarok. Actually,
because as you were alluding to this before I rudely interrupted you, the Ragnarok ends with the death of almost all of the gods, and yet the gods don't fully die somehow. Their cycle begins again. They begin to rebuild Midgard, the world.
Exactly. A new sun is placed in the sky to replace the sun that was eaten by a wolf. A man and a woman were hiding in the world tree, and they will go out and repopulate the world. and a few gods, few young gods, Thor's sons, and for some reason, rather inexplicably, Baldur the Brave, back from the dead, which makes more sense if you think of him as a sun god, and if the sun was gone and now he is back, come out, and they go to where the halls of Asgard were, and now it's this beautiful green place where there really aren't any buildings, and they find chess pieces, the chess pieces of the gods, golden chess pieces of the gods in the grass.
Was that your invention, this ending that you came to?
The statement that they find golden chess pieces in the grass is in Snorri. The idea that the pieces, that the golden chess pieces that they find are in the shapes of the gods who have died.
And their enemies.
And their enemies. And that as they start to play the game begins over again, is something that I brought to the table.
So this story that you're telling about the story of Ragnarok as you retold it here coincides with your own little micro-blizzard apocalypse, quite strangely now, which is that you lost your original version of this story. You had to rewrite it, and you rewrote it, as it were, in a kind of repetition with a difference.
In a repetition with a difference, and it sort of gained a somewhat more beautiful and odd and transcendent ending.
It is quite a nice ending.
Because of that.
Yeah.
But I do love the fact that, you know, if you compare the... if you compare the Revelation of St. John, the Christian apocalypse tradition, with Ragnarok, there are some huge differences. There is no judgment. There isn't the idea of judgment. There is, yes, you have an apocalyptic war. But then there's also that part of me that wants to go, look, none of the religions, none of the stories in that era were occurring on their own in a vacuum. We know through metallurgic tests that the Vikings' best swords came from Afghanistan. That was where they would go to go and get the best swords or the trade routes. People told each other stories. People with different religious beliefs, people with different story beliefs would trade stories. Stories were currency. And you have these Germanic religions that spread up into Scandinavia. The idea that they could share a continent for 800 years with Christians and not swap ideas backwards and forwards, not swap stories, it, to me, seems almost impossible because people tell stories.
So that, I mean, this experience of finding your own way to retell that particular story was serendipitous, maybe ultimately fortunate, certainly frustrating. Are you normally a rewriter, though, or are you a one draft and done tinkerer? What sort of writer are you in the revision process?
I'm a write, if possible, in longhand.
Do you, I've heard you use a fountain pen, June Thomas fountain pen aficionado here at Slate.
Yeah, I absolutely take out fountain pens, displays.
Do you have a favorite one?
I love my well, I, for
is
signing,
Waterman?
For travel, no, this is a Pilot 823
Beautiful.
Amber, and this is for signing things. It's the best signing pen that I know. It's perfectly weighted.
For the listener at home, Neil has opened his jacket and has a literal brace of pens within.
I do. For handwriting novel pens, I love the Lamy 2000. There's a whole bunch, but they're different. They're slower. They're more precise pens than big flowing signature pens. But what I try and do is draft in handwriting and then do a draft on the computer, typing stuff in, transcribing what I've written before. This is where I can change things. I can change names and colors and what have you. So there's, I think of the handwritten draft as like the zeroth draft. What then goes onto the computer is the first draft. And the difference between the first draft as written and the first draft published is very small, but very small. But the differences are always important and critical. I think of myself as a better editor than I am a writer, in that I'm pretty good at taking something that's good but not great and making it great. Even if it wasn't great to begin with, I can sort of polish it and go, ah, okay, this is what it is about thematically. Let me go in and just buttress that and shave this off, and then suddenly it'll fly.
Yeah. Are there other folks who are habitually involved in your writing and editing process? I mean, you worked for years with the great comic book editor Karen Berger at Vertigo, DC Comics, on Sandman and I think some other projects as well. Was it just Sandman?
And Books of Magic and
Books of Magic,
things.
Of course. Yeah, yeah.
I've been very fortunate. I've had really good editors, but yeah. Even more important than good editors, I've had good friends. Mm. And I've had good friends who happen to be really good writers or thinkers or critics. Mm-hmm. So that I know that if I finish a novel and there is a draft ready to go out to friends to be read, I have people whose opinions I'm interested in and will listen to. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The most tragic one for me, though, is my friend John M. Ford, who was an astonishingly good writer. Mike Ford, he won the World Fantasy Award some years ago for a novel called The Dragon Waiting, which doesn't actually have any dragons in it, but is an alternate universe sort of Richard III with vampires. And as astonishing writer. Uh-huh. And Mike was my favorite beta reader.
What does that mean?
It means that he would read it and he would go, you fix that. This moment where this character shows up is a bit cheap. Or this thing, you could do it better. How about doing this? And he was always right. And he was always there and reliable. And, I've missed him. He died about a decade ago or a little bit more. And not having Mike as a beta reader has always been hard for me.
Yeah, I would imagine. Well, in writing your most recent book in Norse mythology, which we've been speaking about so much, you are, as we've said here, already doing a certain work of rewriting. In this case, it just happens to be of ancient poets and prose writers, relatively ancient, rather than of your own work. Yeah. Was the process of bringing this book together significantly different from the work of writing that you've done in the past?
No, completely. I've never done anything like this before. I don't know that I'll ever do anything quite like this again. Because essentially, when I've tried to explain it to people, I say, look, it was my knitting. Mm-hmm. I have aunts who knit, and they tend to have capacious handbags. And whenever they're bored or waiting for a bus or something, the bag will open and the knitting will come out, and they'll just do a couple of rows of knitting and then mm-hmm. it'll go away. There are 20-odd stories in Norse mythology. And what I would tend to do is, when I was finished with something, I would write a Norse mythology story. Hmm. So, I whatever I was working on at the time, whether it was writing scripts or whether it was writing comics, I was working on Sandman Overture. During that period, I was writing some television scripts. I was finishing up Ocean at the End of the Lane. All of these things, I would go off after one of these things was done and I would do a story. Mm-hmm. And then a couple of months later, I'd do another one. Mm-hmm. And it was a very slow way of doing it. And then when they were done, I'd send them off to Amy Cherry.
This was your editor at Norton?
My editor at Norton, whose editorial response normally consisted of saying, when do I get the next one? which I think was possibly the best possible one.
Yeah. It's interesting that you describe the process in that way, though, because it's a stylistically quite consistent book. There are variances from paragraph to paragraph as you shift perspectives or storytelling techniques, but the overall feel of the book is quite coherent to me.
That was much more – it took me several years after agreeing to do the book to begin it. That was because I was, first of all, rereading Snorri and rereading the Eddas, the prose and the poetic Edda. And then it was because I was trying to work out a voice that was wholly mine. Mm. I'd read some fantastic Norse adaptations over the years. Roger Lanceling Green did Myths of the Norsemen, which I loved as a small boy. Kevin Crossley Holland, a fantastic writer and poet, did the Penguin Norse myths.
I grew up with the Dural's Norse gods and giants, for what it's worth, which maybe not one of your greatest hits, but it influenced my my knowledge of these stories.
Absolutely. I mean, I was lucky because I'd read various versions, but those two in particular had always just struck me as beautifully written.
Yeah.
And beautifully retold.
You were working from translations of the Eddas and of Snorri's writing,
and what,
right?
What actually got fun with that was because I would write it in hotel rooms, because I would write it all around the world, I would just sort of pull out my phone. I bought lots of translations of the Eddas, but they were always at home. Mm-hmm. And I was always on the road. So I would go to my phone, hit Project Gutenberg, read like three different public domain translations from the 1890s and go, okay. And then I'd go and read literal word for word translation and think, okay. So I think I know what you're getting at here, and that's been cleaned up a bit, but that's good. And then I would just descend into it. Mm. Probably the most useful thing, apart from the prose and poetic Eddas, was a dictionary that I bought back when I was doing American Gods by a German professor named Rudi Simek, his dictionary of Northern mythology, which is just really comprehensive, incredibly well thought out. Absolutely useful guide, not only to the gods, but to where each thing comes from. So if there was anything, so if you're sitting there going, well, I know that oaths sworn on Odin's spear are unbreakable, but I have no idea where that actually occurs. I could go to the Simek book and find out.
You've alluded to your book, your novel, American Gods, which has relatively recently also been adapted for television in an ongoing way. Terrific Brian Fuller project. But this gets at something that I think when we think about your Norse mythology book is important too in terms of the shape of your career, which is that you have been in one way or another, not always quite so directly, but you have in one way or another been telling and retelling stories of the Norse gods for decades.
Yeah.
Several of these gods appear as characters over the course of your run in Sandman. There is, of course, their role in American Gods, which I won't spoil, but it's there if you know the etymology of the word Wednesday. And I assume there are other places where you've touched on these stories that I'm forgetting. What was it like in terms of the arc of your working life to come back to these characters that you had spent so much time with here and there in such a intense way?
Really beautiful. It was – sometimes it's really nice to come and find the simplicities of things. I first wrote the Norse gods in Sandman. I remember the joy of bringing on – my Odin and my Loki and my huge over-muscled Thor in a storyline called Season of Mists. And then coming back to them again in American Gods, where Mr. Wednesday, who is an incarnation of Odin, is the one of the prime characters running all the way through the story. So actually being able to tell the stories, I've alluded a few times to having to find the voice. Mm-hmm. And for me, finding the voice was so important because I needed something that felt right, that felt mythic, but also felt absolutely accessible. Mm-hmm. I wanted a smart 9-year-old, a smart 12-year-old to be able to pick up the book and understand it and know who these characters are and find the jokes funny. Mm-hmm. In the same way that I wanted a 40-year-old or an 80-year-old with good taste to read it and go, yeah, actually, he knows what he's talking about and this feels right. Mm-hmm. The late Ursula Le Guin wrote a beautiful essay called From Elfland to Poughkeepsie. And she grumbled about the fact that in a lot of modern writers, characters who should be in Elfland talk as if they're in Poughkeepsie. Mm-hmm. And I always try to be aware of that. And I never, you know, in American Gods, I'm very happy to go all the way to Poughkeepsie.
They belong there in that book, I think.
They do. But in this book, I wanted to stay in Elfland.
Yeah. Well, I think you hit it. We should probably come to a close. I want to ask before we wrap up, though, about wrapping up, about ending things. And this is a book about Ragnarok. And in Sandman, the end of the story you tell, or at least the end of the story you told in the first run of Monthly Comics, was inscribed in the stars from the very first issues in some ways. In your radio play and comic Signal to Noise, you suggest that the world is always ending for someone.
Yeah.
How do you know when you've finished a story? When are you done telling a story?
I'm done when I want to tell the next one.
Yeah.
And that really tends to be how I know. I know that I'm finished when my head is filled with the next story. Mm-hmm. When actually, I forget who it was who said that art is never finished, only abandoned. Mm-hmm. But they were right. You never quite finish things. It's never perfect. It's there as much as you can get it because we are imperfect creatures in a physical world filled with imperfect objects and imperfect ideas, and we have language, we do not have telepathy, and it's going to be good enough. Mm. But there always has to be a point where you let it go. I once, a long time ago, was working with a now dead artist called Steve Whitaker, and I knew Steve and I liked Steve enormously, and he was a colorist. And apart from being a very good artist, he also colored other people's comics. He worked with David Lloyd to color V for Vendetta. And I asked Steve if he would be interested in coloring Sandman. And he said yes, he'd love to color Sandman. And we sent him some pages to try out. And Steve was much better than the person who eventually wound up coloring Sandman, Robbie Bush. But he never turned in the pages because they were never perfect. And every time I'd see him, I'd say, Steve, we're waiting to see what you're going to do. And he'd show me some stuff. And I'd say, great, can you send it off? And he'd say, no. It's not quite perfect yet. But I really want, this is my chance at the big job and it has to be perfect. And eventually the bus left without him because the comic had to be colored and it had to be published. And Steve never got to do the job because the work was never perfect. And that kind of taught me a lesson in going, okay, let things go. They may not be perfect. Maybe you'll get it perfect next time. I would always rather go, I'd rather get it perfect in the next book, in the next poem, in the next chapter, in the next comic, than spend my entire life trying to perfect a sentence, a word.
Maybe that's the lesson of Norse mythology and its own ending too, that endings are messy and bloody, and sometimes something else just starts in their wake.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us to chat today. This has been so delightful.
I've loved it. What great questions. And chatting with you has been so much fun. So thank you.
It's been fun for me. Thank you. Thanks for listening to this episode of Working. I'm Jacob Brogan. We'll be back next week with more animal stories as we finish off this season about working animals. This week, we also want to recommend the Slate podcast Hit Parade. On Hit Parade, Chris Malamphy takes you on a fascinating journey through pop chart history, whether it's the week the Beatles swept the entire top five on the Billboard charts or the unlikely reign of MC Hammer's You Can't Touch This. Hit Parade explores the people and the politics behind the songs you hear on the radio. Check out Hit Parade everywhere you download podcasts. This week, we also have in the studio with us my friend Katie Lazarus. She's a writer and a podcast host, a host of the show Employee of the Month. Katie's here to tell us a little about that show and to tell us about a live show that she's doing in New York on March 15th.
Yeah, so the podcast is recorded live. Employee of the Month is recorded live sometimes. And we're having the 9th year anniversary, which is very exciting. Gramercy Theater, March 15th. And if people are in New York or the Triborough area, they should definitely come, Slate listeners, because it's going to be super fun. And I'm going to have on the show Hannibal Buress, who you may recognize from his, I think, 4 comedy specials, as well as being on 30 Rock, SNL, Broad City, the Eric Andre show. He's really hilarious. Alex Lacamoire, who did the music for this teeny off-Broadway show that no one's heard of. I think it's called Hamilton. And he's actually going to perform as well. And the Resistance Revival Choir got a whole choir because they are phenomenal. They've shown other people how to start their own choirs as well. They were just on the Grammys with Kesha and at the Women's March. And then Emily Mortimer, who just had 2 big breakout films at Sundance. So it should be a lot of fun. My band is part of Lin-Manuel Miranda's Freestyle Love Supreme, and it's just a really fun ride about work. It's a glimpse into people's lives.
That sounds awesome. Thanks again for coming in to tell us about Employee of the Month.
Looking forward to seeing you there and everyone else.
Here at Working, we are always delighted to hear from you. You can email us via working@slate.com. You can hit me up on Twitter. I'm Jacob_Brogan. Reach out to me, reach out to us, however you want. And also, if you have the chance, rate and review the show. This episode of Working was produced and edited by Benjamin Frisch.